In the late 60s and in the 70s, one of the hippest comedy groups was the Fire Sign Theater. Their sketches were famous for their surrealism, absurdities, non sequiturs, crazy paranoia, parodies of the establishment, in-jokes about hippies, and knowing allusions to literature and trash culture. One of the founders of the group, Peter Bergman, died Friday at the age of 72 from complications of leukemia. Firesign made intricately layered, multi-track comedy records such as Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him and Don't Crush the Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. They all loved old-time radio and often parodied it. From the 1969 album, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All? Here's Peter Bergman doing a radio commercial in the middle of the old-time radio sketch, The Further Adventures of Nick Danger.
All right, hold it right where you are. I'm Lieutenant Bradshaw with a piece of advice for you. Now, here in the studio, it's all knuckles and know-how. But when that red light goes off, I'm just plain Harry Ames, citizen and weekend father. Now, take a tip from a cop who does. Radio work can be just as dirty and exciting as hunting down public enemy number one. So when I get home, my old lady knows what I need and how. A warm, heaping bowl full of looseners, castor oil flakes with real glycerin vibrafoam. It doesn't just wash your mouth out. It cleans the whole system right on down the line. So come on, you little rookies. Tell your mom to get on it and do it every day. Just remember what the guys down at the precinct house sing.
Oh, it ain't no use if you ain't got the boost you get from looseners. Looseners.
The all-weather breakfast.
I spoke with three members of the Firesign Theater in 1993 after the release of a Best of Firesign anthology. Here's a short excerpt of what Peter Bergman had to say. I asked him to do one or two of the voices he was known for.
Well, I'm Peter Bergman, and in Dwarf, well, I play Mudhead, you know. Gee, Porge, I didn't know you masturbated. You know,
golly,
that's my
Mudhead.
Line. And on the other hand, in Nick Danger, I'm the tough Lieutenant Bradshaw, shut up, Danger. That's how you'll recognize me.
Let's do a little bit of Firesign history here. You guys got together when you had a radio show called...
Yep.
What
radio
was the show
Free
called?
Oz.
Radio Free Oz. This was on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles.
KPFK.
Listener supported.
So what kind of stuff were you doing then?
Well, this started in the summer of 1966, and FM then basically was dedicated to classical music and was not a big entertainment, pop entertainment medium at all. And I'd heard Bob Fass's show on BAI just before I came out to
that's
California.
That's the New York Pacifica station.
And he was doing mixes of sound and all kind of, and I was very much involved in what was then the avant-garde pop culture. I'd been tangentially with the Living Theater. I'd been over in Europe. I was in a playwriting seminar with a young guy named Tom Stoppard, a young guy named Piers Paul Reed, and a young guy named Derek Marlowe, and me. There's these four 24-year-olds writing.
In Berlin.
Yeah, and that's where Stoppard wrote Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, was in this little house where we all worked. So I came back all full of the avant-garde, went out to California, started this radio show, and I was playing Indian music, and Andy Warhol was on in the Buffalo Springfield, and all this pop culture and astrology and tarot. And it was a crazy late-night show, and people were going mad behind it. And in walked Phil Proctor, that I worked with in drama from Yale. He was the leading man in the musicals that I had worked with. David Osmond had just left the station as its PD and gone to put a suit on with ABC, which was not making him very happy. And Phil Austin was engineering and kind of co-producing the show. Well, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, really out of nowhere, the four of us got together. I'd been doing comedy on Radio Free Oz already. We decided to do this thing called the Oz...
Film Festival.
Film Festival Jury. And just before we went on the show that night, November 17th, 1966, I, who was an astrologer at the time, Monkey, I said, well, you're all fire signs. We're all fire signs. We're the fire sign. We're the Oz Fire Sign Theater.
That was Peter Bergman of the Fire Sign Theater, recorded in 1993. He died Friday at the age of 72. Here's Bergman as Lieutenant Bradshaw in the old-time radio detective parody, The Further Adventures of Nick Danger, Third Eye, from a 1969 album.
And now we return you to Act 3 of Nick Danger, Third Eye.
When the crazy escalator ride ended, I fought my way back up to the land of the living. I came to slumped over in the front seat of my own car, lying in a pool of cheap rot gut. I had a head full of ideas that were driving me insane and a mouthful of cotton candy.
You want to
want some more cotton candy, Danger? It might sober you up.
Oh, my head. Bradshaw, baby.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd be happy to see your ugly mug.
Save the wisecracks for the warden, Danger. I got you this time, and I got you good.
What are you talking about?
Get out of that car.
Hey, come on.
If you can stand up. And keep your hands high, I got you covered.
Hey, what's this all about, Bradshaw? You know I never carry a rod.
Yeah, but it's murder what some people can do with a car, and I got witnesses to prove it.
There's the man! Keep me away from him!
Take it easy, little lady.
I don't know why you're doing this, Nancy, but it doesn't change my feelings about you.
Oh, Nick, you're such a tool! He did it!
All right, take it easy, little lady. All right, now let's get these facts straight. Take this down, Henderson. Okay, Professor, how did it happen?
Well, Sergeant...
Lieutenant.
Yes, Mrs. Farber and I were sitting right here in the living room engaged in a friendly round of spin the pickle, weren't we, dear? Yes, with our good friend Mr. Rococo.
He did it.
Yes, and then suddenly the door flew open and this drunken madman right here drove in, honking wildly and headed straight for us.
He's lying, Bradshaw!
Can it, Danger?
Yes, at the last possible moment, he stopped on a dime.
I see.
Unfortunately, the dime was in Mr. Rococo's pocket.
I'm going to break your neck, Catherwood!
All right. Hold it, Danger. I've heard enough. We'll get the rest of the story down at the station house from you. I've been waiting for this for years.
Wise up, Bradshaw.
Week in and week out,
I didn't
Danger,
do it.
Playing second fiddle while you got all the girls.
Come on.
I'm tired of being Mr. Nice Guy. See, there's going to be some changes made. Next week, this show is going to be called...
Sergeant Bradshaw,
Lieutenant.
District Attorney!
I'm going to have my own theme music, and it's all going to take place in Washington, D.C. No plots, just girls and guys doing nice, simple things up against Nazis and fifth columnists, and no Jewish writers either.
I saw my chance, and I took it.
In the papers.
Bradshaw
my
would never listen to my story now.
Colonel
it had more
Linder,
holes in it than
Charles
Albert Hall.
Foster Kane.
My only way up was like this!
That was the Firesign Theater with Peter Bergman as Lieutenant Bradshaw. Bergman died Friday at the age of 72.
If you love St. Patrick's Day but you hate green, Nike has the shoe for you, or so it thought.
The athletic apparel behemoth is releasing a new version of its SB Dunk Low, a popular casual shoe. It is black and tan colored, and since we're getting close to St. Paddy's Day, the shoe has a nickname that is apparently beer-inspired. The black and tan.
And that's where Nike gets into trouble. Here in the U.S. or in Britain, you might order a black and tan at a pub and get a mixture of an Irish stout, such as Guinness, and a lager, like Harp. But that's not the original meaning of black and tan.
I talked today with Brian Boyd of the Irish Times newspaper, and he explained.
It has certain historical associations. The black and tans were a ruthless auxiliary force of the British Army before we became independent in the 1920s. They were responsible for wide-scale massacres, butchering of people. We don't even, for example, in the US, you may go into a bar and ask for a drink, call it black and tan.
And that would be, I'm not saying this from great personal familiarity, that would be a half of a black beer, like a Guinness, and a half of a pale ale with it. But you wouldn't call it that in Ireland.
No, we'd use different terms. And in fact, we wouldn't really dilute our Guinness over here. It's not really the done thing to do.
Now, Nike has released a statement saying, "We apologize. No offense was intended." At the same time, Nike says the sneaker has been, quote, unofficially named by some as the black and tan.
That said, if you look inside the shoe, as we have done with online photos, you see an image of a pint of beer with two colors, black and tan.
Brian Boyd of the Irish Times has reported on some outrage over the shoe, but really, he says, it's not about a shoe. It's about a holiday.
It's how the Americans view St. Patrick's Day and view Irish culture and history. And it's the very fact that some people are saying that these are beer-themed sneakers, that the only way to celebrate a national holiday of a country with a very rich culture and a very rich history in literature, etc., is to pour massive amounts of alcohol down your body. It's how the Americans treat St. Patrick's Day. Mm-hmm. So we're using this story to say, look, it's the silly Americans, stupid Americans, look what they're doing again. They've got it all wrong.
Which is, by the way, a default mode for journalism across the pond.
But still, it seems Nike did not have its smartest moment with the black and tan shoe. All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There, you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Biancooley. This Sunday, Discovery Channel presents the first two installments of Frozen Planet, its newest nature documentary made in collaboration with England's BBC TV. It's from the same team that produced the brilliantly photographed Planet Earth, and I love this new TV series just as much. But once again, I have the same single complaint, the one grating flaw in an otherwise exceptional television program. I don't want to complain about Frozen Planet, however, until I dish out a little praise. Frozen Planet is the kind of program that television was made for, and, even more certainly, the kind that modern TV was made for. This series not only takes us, quite literally, to the coldest, most remote places on Earth, but captures images of so much majesty, artistry, and clarity, it's almost ridiculous. On a large-screen, high-definition TV, watching Frozen Planet is like having your own personal IMAX theater. The newest technology affects not only how we see these images, but how they're photographed. Even since Planet Earth was made a handful of years ago, advances in video technology have allowed camera crews, armed with the latest equipment, to capture action in unprecedented ways. There's even time-lapse photography so precise and so carefully planned out that it pans and zooms while telescoping weeks and months into less than a minute. The result is a glacier that advances like a slow-motion bulldozer, crushing and moving everything in its path. The images are fantastic. A mammoth elephant seal, protecting his claim to a female, engages in a furious bloody fight with an encroaching male. And if he's successful, he has to fight again, almost once an hour for several days, each time battling a fresh, determined rival. At the end, we see a dazed, bloody, obviously exhausted elephant seal making his way back to his mate. He may not be wondering whether she was worth it all, but I sure was. And that's the thing about any nature documentary done well. One thing it should do is make us cherish and think about the beauty and value and fragility of the natural world. More on that in a minute. The other thing it should do is make us empathize with the natural drama of everyday survival. Television has been doing this quite effectively ever since the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau and the nature specials presented by Walt Disney. And it's true that in many places in Frozen Planet, the narration, the music, and the simple storytelling combine to make it all feel like a much higher-tech equivalent of one of those Disney programs. Narrator Alec Baldwin, in the episode called Spring, describes the nest-building efforts of some Antarctic penguins. The males, he explains, build nests out of small pebbles on patches of dry land because eggs would freeze within minutes if resting on snow or ice. And in this scene, the camera tracks one male penguin as he makes the long trek to find and return with one pebble at a time. The camera also catches a neighbor penguin who waits until the other's back is turned to steal his rock. This happens again and again, and everything about the way it's presented makes it look and sound like a silent film comedy or a classic Disney nature moment.
The hapless victim seems completely unaware he's being robbed blind. But somehow, the more rocks he gathers, the smaller his nest becomes. Meanwhile, the thief's nest is coming along nicely, probably because he keeps a sharp eye out for rock robbers. After all, it takes one to know one.
And that leads to my problem with Discovery Channel's Frozen Planet. As with Planet Earth, where the American network hired Sigourney Weaver to replace the original narration by Sir David Attenborough, this time Alec Baldwin gets the call. Attenborough survives, however, on the most important episode of the series, called On Thin Ice, because that's the one where he speaks from very personal experience as more than 50 years as a BBC nature documentary filmmaker about how and why the Earth is changing, and, yes, globally warming. Replacing Attenborough for any of these shows is very insulting. But everything else about Frozen Planet is very inspiring. Even the making of episode is a winner. Listen to Mark, a cameraman who's waited weeks to capture the moment when a frozen waterfall suddenly thaws, as he finally and barely gets the angle and the daylight to get the shot he needs. Baldwin sets the stage.
In the middle of the night, as the frozen planet team feared, the town was alerted that the frozen waterfall was about to break.
They just called a full evacuation of the island where we're staying. If we don't move now, we're all going to be underwater and possibly get trapped here for a few days.
They had to race to the waterfall, hoping that it didn't give way before daybreak. It held off, and they got there just in time.
That is a serious amount of ice coming around the corner. After weeks of waiting, sleeping giant of a river, we thought nothing was going to happen. And suddenly, look at this. This is what we're here for. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
The executive producer of Frozen Planet, Alastair Fothergill, has worked on Planet Earth, Blue Planet, and Attenborough's classic The Trials of Life. The two even teamed up for a previous visit to the Antarctic almost 20 years ago for a fine series called Life in the Freezer. But it's good to know, somehow, that with all this knowledge, all these brilliant filmmakers, and all this modern equipment, many times getting just the right shot at just the right time is a matter of dumb, simple luck. And that makes me feel very lucky to be able to sit back in the comfort of my own home and watch the astonishing results.
There's something fascinating about people who don't just quit, but who go out the door in some kind of grand style. A personal favorite is a disgruntled grocery store worker in Seattle who wrote, "I quit in Cheese Whiz" on the customer service window before leaving. And at the top of any list of recent job quits has to be the JetBlue airline steward, Stephen Slater.
The flight attendant who had a major meltdown is out on bail this morning.
After 28 years as a flight attendant, Slater gained folk hero status in the summer of 2010. After a flight with some difficult passengers, at least according to Slater's version of events, Slater loudly quit his job over the plane's intercom, using the F word many times, then grabbed a beer and went down the plane's emergency exit slide.
Stephen Slater walked out of a New York City lockup to a crush of photographers.
You gonna lose your job?
More than likely.
Slater's grand exit was picked up by all the news networks. There were countless internet tributes, some of them musical.
So he commandeered and grabbed a beer and spoke his mind. Yeah, he flipped the latch and out the hatch and down the slide.
For some reason, there is definitely an element of the heroic in dramatic job quits. That someone is willing to sacrifice their future job prospects for the glory of the moment. Although, in the case of the Goldman Sachs executive Greg Smith, given his pay scale, he probably doesn't need to find another job right away.
This is kind of id, pure id.
Ben Dattner is an organizational psychologist and the founder of Dattner Consulting, which works with major companies on executive coaching and culture change. He says there is a vicarious thrill about watching somebody else give in to the desire to do something that we know we shouldn't do.
The desire for revenge, the desire for public retribution, without thinking more rationally about what are the consequences for me and for my career.
In the Goldman case, the company said it will examine claims by former employee Greg Smith that executives, quote, callously talk about ripping off their clients. Dattner says Goldman probably should do some self-examination.
Perhaps there's also something for Goldman to learn about an employee who was pushed to the breaking point.
In recent years, some employees' over-the-edge moments have been captured on tape and then posted on YouTube. One hotel worker in Providence, Rhode Island, named Joey, snuck in members of his ragtag-looking brass band to the hotel, and they played a surprise protest march to his boss when he quit his job.
Guys, all of you out right now.
Jared, I'm here to tell you that I'm quitting.
And there was a DJ at the Gulf Coast radio station WBLX. She went by the name Inetta the Mood Setta. She had had enough, too, and quit on the air.
For the last 6 years, I made $6 an hour. That ain't nothing. But I never will not be setting the mood at BLX no more.
Chris Arnold, happily employed at NPR News.
I can't take it. I'm not going to take it. I don't have to take it. I'm not a dummy. I know how to find another job, but I refuse to walk around.